Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents At Home in the Dark. Edited by Lawrence Block. Narrated by Peter Burkrot and Terry Schnaubelt. It's Getting Dark in Here. A foreword by Lawrence Block. Ages ago, Lucille Ball had this exchange on I Love Lucy with a snobbish character whose task it was to elevate her culturally. Snob. Now, there are two words I never want to hear you say. One is swell, and the other is lousy. Lucy. Okay, let's start with the lousy one. Funny what lingers in the mind. Every year or so, I stub my toe on a couple of buzzwords and decide I'd just as soon not encounter them again. There are two that I've found increasingly annoying of late, and if Lucy were here, I'd tell her that one of them is awesome and the other is iconic. It is in the nature of the spoken language for words to come and go, and none are more cyclical than those we choose to indicate strong approval or disapproval. Swonderful, Cole Porter told us, that you should care for me. Indeed, smarvelous, isn't it? Wonderful, marvelous, terrific, sensational, excellent, brilliant. Each takes its turn as a way of demonstrating great positive enthusiasm. For quite a few years now, le mot du jour has been awesome. Now, it's a perfectly reasonable word, and means simply that the noun thus modified is likely to inspire awe, even as that which is wonderful is clearly full of wonder. If everything thus described is truly awesome, one is left to contemplate a generation of wide-eyed and slack-jawed folk gaping at all that is arrayed in front of them. Well, okay. Periodically, a word of approval swims upstream into the zeitgeist, resonates with enough of us to have an impact, and becomes the default term for us all, or at least those of us under 40. Before too long, its original meaning has been entirely subsumed, and all it means to call something awesome is that one likes it. Deep down where it lives, awesome is essentially identical in meaning to awful. And there was a time when awful and wonderful were synonyms, full of awe, full of wonder. Now, as Lucy could tell you, one is swell and the other is lousy. If anything good is awesome, then anything memorable or distinctive is iconic. I shouldn't complain, I don't suppose, as several of my own books have had that label applied to them, and perhaps I ought to regard the whole business as awesome. But iconic? Really? No narcissist thinks more highly of his own work than I, but I have trouble picturing any of my books as literal icon, displayed on the wall of a Russian Orthodox cathedral. Wait, let me rethink that. Maybe 8 million Ways to Die might make the cut. I mean, dude, that book is awesome. Never mind. I have the honor to present to you 17 stories, any or all of which you might well describe as awesome or iconic, or both. And I want to introduce them by pointing out another buzzword, of one of which I've tired at least as much as I have of the two of them combined. Noir. It's a perfectly good word, and particularly useful if you're in Paris and an ominous feline crosses your path. Un chat noir, you might say, or you might offer a Gallic shrug and pretend you hadn't seen it. Noir is the French word for black, but when it makes its way across la mer, it manages to gain something in translation. Early on, it became attached to a certain type of motion picture. A French critic named Nino Frank coined the term film noir in 1946, but it took a couple of decades for the phrase to get any traction. I could tell you what does and doesn't constitute classic film noir, and natter on about its visual style, with roots in German expressionist cinematography, But you can check out Wikipedia as well as I can. That, after all, is what I did, and how I happen to know about Nino Frank. Or you can read a recent novel of mine, The Girl with the Deep Blue Eyes. The protagonist, an ex-NYPD cop-turned-Florida private eye, is addicted to the cinematic genre. When he's not acting out a role in his own real-life film noir, he's on the couch with his feet up, watching how Hollywood used to do it. That's what the French word for black is doing in the English language. It's modifying the word film, and describes a specific example thereof. Now, though, it's all over the place. The credit, or the blame, if you prefer, goes to Johnny Temple of Akashic Books. In 2004, Akashic published Brooklyn Noir, Tim McLaughlin's anthology of original crime stories set in that borough. They did very well with it, well enough to prompt McLaughlin to compile and Akashic to publish a sequel, Brooklyn Noir 2, The Classics, consisting of reprint. It did well, too, and a lot of publishers would have let it go at that. But Akashic went on to publish a whole cottage industry of darkness. A look at the publisher's website shows a total of 120 published and forthcoming noir titles, but the number is sure to be higher by the time you read this. Akashic clearly subscribes to the notion that every city has a dark side and deserves a chance to tell its own stories. It is, I must say, a wholly estimable enterprise. I could not begin to estimate the number of writers whose first appearance in print has come in an Akashic anthology. They owe Akashic a debt of gratitude, as does a whole world of readers. And as do I. I had the pleasure of editing Manhattan Noir and Manhattan Noir 2, and while neither brought me wealth beyond the dreams of avarice, each was a source of personal and artistic satisfaction. And, after I'd coaxed a couple of friends into writing stories for my anthology, I could hardly demur when they turned the tables on me. I'd written one myself for Manhattan Noir, and wrote another for S.J. Rosen's Bronx Noir, and a third for Sarah Cortez and Bootsy Martinez's Indian Country Noir. All three were about the same cheerfully homicidal young woman, and although she didn't yet have a name, she clearly had a purpose in life. I found more stories to write about her, realized they were chapters of a novel in progress, and in time, Getting Off was published by Hard Case Crime. So I wish their series continued success. Although their stories have never had much to do with Hollywood's 1940 version of noir, neither are they happy little tales full of kitty cats and bunny rabbits. They are serious stories, taking in the main a hard line on reality, and any grayscale would show them on the dark end of the spectrum. Noir? Noirish? Okay, fine. I'm happy for them to go on using the word. In fact, I'm all for letting them trademark it, just so the rest of the world could quit using it. That, gentle reader, is a rant. And you can relax now. I'm done with it. So, here we have 17 stories, and you'll note that they cover a lot of ground in terms of genre. Most are crime fiction to a greater or lesser degree. But James Reasoner's is a period western, and Joe Hill's is horror, and Joe R. Lansdale's is set in a dystopian future. And what they all have in common, besides their unquestionable excellence, is where they stand on that gray scale. They are, in a word, dark. And that, I must confess, is the modifier I greatly prefer to noir. It's easy to see I'm partial to it. A few years ago, I put together a collection of New York stories for Three Rooms Press, and the title I fastened upon was Dark City Lights. While I was at it, I fastened as well upon some of that book's contributors. Of the writers in At Home in the Dark, six of them, Ed Park, Jim Fusilli, Thomas Plock, Jill D. Blanc, Elaine Kagan, and Warren Moore, wrote stories for Dark City Lights. The title came to me early on. Years ago, I'd come across O. Henry's last words, spoken on his deathbed, and in case you missed them in the epigraph, you needn't flip pages. "Turn up the lights," said the master of the surprise ending. "I don't want to go home in the dark." I can but hope you enjoy At Home in the Dark. I find it's inspired me, and there's another anthology taking shape in my mind even now. I already have a title in mind, and it's 5 words long, as my titles tend to be, and it has the word dark in it. Trust me, it'll be awesome.
Hot Pants by Elaine Kagan. "Dad," Lucinda said. Her father was snoring, relaxed and long in a faded chintz wing chair, legs out in front of him, ankles crossed, size 13 feet and thick white socks on a matching faded chintz ottoman. The chair was permanently placed in front of a large TV screen that was permanently tuned to Turner Classic Movies. The movie playing that morning was something in black and white with Jimmy Cagney, or maybe it was Mickey Rooney, she wasn't sure which, tapping around a giant movie set that was supposed to look like a street in downtown Manhattan. The guy could really dance. People shuffled in and out to the long living room. The sound was turned way down on the TV, and most of the people pushing their walkers across the ratty rug were silent and smiling. Some sat motionless, like kids playing dead, jaws dropped, heads thrown back, eyes closed. Like zombies, Lucinda thought. 12 white zombies being herded around a big rambling two-story house by 2 brown women, 1 brown man, 1 black woman and 2 black men, rotating hours and days in blue scrubs in Newark, New Jersey. Mrs. Ventimiglia sat at the piano, her hands folded and quiet in her lap. She never played, and it wasn't clear if she was looking at the sheet music on the piano table or out the window. Her daughter said she'd been a really terrific jazz pianist. Very Bill Evans, her daughter said. Lucinda had to look up Bill Evans. Mrs. Ventimiglia had also been a reporter for the New York Post, and it was ironic that Mr. Santangelo, who spent most of his time on the cracked leather sofa across from the fireplace that had no logs, was reading a yellowed copy of the New York Post that he carried around in his pocket. It didn't seem to matter that the news wasn't current. Lucinda didn't know if Mrs. Ventimiglia and Mr. Santangelo had ever even spoken. Mr. Santangelo was in pretty good shape, except for every now and then when he had a screaming fit and threw things. No one so far had figured out what set him off. "He's nuts," her father said. Lucinda leaned forward, her face closer to her father's. "Daddy?" His feet jumped a little, and the snoring stopped with an abrupt intake of breath, as if he'd stopped breathing altogether for maybe 20 seconds, and then started up again, like a car engine. Not as loud, but still strong. He was still strong, her father. His mind was full of smoke, as he frequently pointed out with a wry laugh when he was in, as he put it, but his body betrayed his 68 years. He looked maybe 58 tops. He had a character actor face with dark red wavy hair and a solid muscular build. No gut above his belt. He had a splatter of freckles across ruddy cheeks, a thick neck, and thick hands. He could probably still jump on and off a fire engine, pull a hose, climb a ladder, chainsaw through a roof, or run into flames looking like the picture poster of how a fire captain should look. Although he just might not be able to remember what a fire engine did, or a hose or a ladder or a chainsaw, or how to brush his teeth, or cut his meat, or recognize Chief Lang when he came to visit. "I know this guy, right?" he said to Lucinda, tilting his head towards the fire chief. Chief Archie Lang and her father had gone through the academy together, had been best men at each other's weddings, and were godfathers to each other's kids. "I'm losing me," her father said in a gruff whisper to Archie Lang, leaning in close and secret. "Don't tell the kid, okay?" "Okay," Chief Lang said, giving a brave nod to Lucinda and an affectionate punch to her dad's upper arm. Lucinda made a concerted effort to not die right there or throw up. He was in and out now, this stalwart father of hers. slipping down the ladder of dementia. Hello. Lucinda looked up. A tiny, wiry woman wearing a print dress with pink socks stuffed into white open-toed house slippers was standing right next to the arm of her chair. She had several strands of beads slung around her neck, hot pink lipstick with blush to match, and she was pushing 90. Hello, Mrs. Moskowitz.
Hello yourself. She looked hard at Lucinda. Do you know this man?
Yes, ma'am, Lucinda said. He's my father.
Uh-huh. Is he Jewish?
Lucinda smiled and shook her head.
He's Italian, Mrs. Moskowitz.
They'd had this same conversation maybe 4 times that morning, and maybe 27 times in the last month.
He doesn't look Italian.
Right, Lucinda said, studying her father. He actually looks Irish. Mrs. Moskowitz sighed.
I had an Italian man once, she said, lowering her voice and giving Lucinda a woman-to-woman stare. He was a no-good Nick, if you know what I mean.
I do.
Well then, she said, pushing her walker forward. I have to get home, she said. My mother will kill me. It's a school night, you know.
Okay, Lucinda said. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. She touched her father's arm, kind of jostled him.
Dad, I have to go to work.
Nicholas John Conte coughed, cleared his throat, and opened his eyes. Clear blue, nothing dimmed in the sight area. He stretched a giant's stretch, folding his arms over his face and then extending them out to the sides, spreading his fingers, lifting his legs straight out in front of him, pointing his toes and flexing, and then down again with the appropriate sounds of a big man stretching.
Hey, Lucy, he said, smiling up at his daughter.
Well, you had a good nap?
I wasn't asleep,
she laughed.
You weren't?
Just checking the inside of my eyelids, he said, and yawned.
He'd been saying that since she could remember. He looked around the room.
Where's your mother?
Dad, Mom hasn't been here for years, you know that. He took maybe a minute to ponder it.
Oh, right, the guy with the boat.
Right.
Who knew she liked boats?
He said and laughed. He looked around the room.
And here I am at the big house.
Dad,
when will my house be ready?
Soon. This was his new thing, fixing it in his head that his house was being worked on, plumbing, paint, new floors, etc. He'd tell you. It was Lucinda's choice to let him believe it. The first few months had been endless battles about him getting out of there.
What the hell is going on here, Lucy? He would shout. Am I a goddamn prisoner?
It came to a near brawl one night with Miguel and Reginald, two of the attendants at the home. It was Reverend Father King's idea to tell him the house was under construction.
You want me to lie, Father?
It's not a lie if you paint the kitchen, Lucinda, he said, leaning back in his chair.
So much for being Catholic.
Damn construction guys, Nick Conte muttered. This always happens, you know. I told you. We'll be done by February. We'll be done by March. Where's the peanut?
In school. I gotta go to work, Dad.
Oh, right, sure, kid,
he said, pulling his feet back and off the ottoman, stuffing them into his loafers, fixing the front of his shirt, running his hand through his hair and standing up.
How is everything?
Good, she said, slipping on her jacket, shrugging her handbag strap over her shoulder and pulling the car keys from her jeans pocket.
Everything good at the restaurant?
Yep.
They make great creamed spinach. It's the nutmeg, you know. That's the ticket.
I know. He put his hand on her shoulder, steering her to the front door.
Did you bring me my lasagna?
Yes, sir. I gave it to Princess. You saw when I got here.
Right. That's your grandmother's recipe, you know.
I know.
Old man Sorrentino had sticky fingers. He could steal your grandma's rosary beads right out of her hand. You know that, right?
She laughed. We'll go Sunday.
Good idea. With the peanut.
She took her father and her 6-year-old daughter Maria to the restaurant every Sunday,
Every single Sunday since she'd moved him into this wretched place that cost her a small fortune and was supposedly one of the best group houses for people with dementia in all of New Jersey, not just in Belleville or Bloomfield, a big old house smelling faintly of old carpet and pine sole and burnt onions and Mrs. Moskowitz's jungle gardenia and someone's adult pamper and bad breath and wet dog, which was ridiculous because there was no dog allowed on the premises, not even to visit, which made no sense because it was a known fact that animals helped people with stress, and there was enough stress in this place to choke a horse, her mother would have said. Her beautiful mother, who had walked out on them when Lucinda was 15, for a cop named Vinny, who worked in Brooklyn, and it was hard to say which was worse, a firefighter's wife leaving him for a cop, or the fact that the cop was from Brooklyn. Not even counting the boat, Vinny had a Chris Craft cabin cruiser, or a Chris Cross cabin cruiser, she wasn't sure which, but it seemed to matter a great deal to her mother.
She likes the pudding.
Who?
The peanut. She likes the pudding at Serendipity's.
Sorrentino's, Dad.
At Sorrentino's, right.
And it's Budino, not pudding. He shrugged.
Budino, pudding, what the hell's the difference?
Lucinda rested her forehead against the steering wheel. It was icy. All of New Jersey was icy. The streets, the bare branches of the trees against the pale sky, her heart. She couldn't take care of him anymore. Not after the thing with the oven. Not after the thing with the car.
You can't take care of him anymore, her Aunt Angie said with defiance, feet planted, arms crossed over her breasts. It's enough. Soon he won't know how to wipe his own ass, she said.
Lucinda's mouth opened.
I can say that. He's my brother, Angie said. What if he takes Maria in the car with him? What if he takes her to Bloomfield Center and loses her, or drives to Philadelphia?
Lucinda actually smiled. Why would Dad go to Philadelphia?
Oh, I don't know,
Angie said, collapsing into a chair, sobbing.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph, my Nicky, what a thing.
It's a good place, Reverend Father King said about the home. It's enough, Lucinda. This is a good place.
She started the car.
¿Cómo está, Lucy?
Jose shouted over the din as she walked into Sorrentino's crowded kitchen. Cooks and waiters, busboys and dishwashers jostled for position at sink and stove and counters, moving pots and pans and plates and food with the precision of the New York Yankees, or possibly the New York City Ballet Company. She wasn't sure which. And in the middle of the whole commotion stood Jose, stacking thick white plates on trays. Jose Conchola had been a busboy at Sorrentino's since Lucinda had been coming there as a little girl. 60 now, he knew all the regulars and they all knew him, a fixture, as faithful as their recipe for lasagna.
I'm fine, she said.
Good.
How's the papa?
The same.
The same is good,
Enrique said, lifting his eyes from a mountain of tomatoes he was chopping.
You think?
I think, yes,
he said emphatically, waving the knife in his hand.
Change is fearful.
Enrique was proud of his English and liked to show off his extensive vocabulary, which wasn't always the use of the correct word at the correct time.
With study, no one will know I am from Puerto Rico,
he would say, which brought down the house, or actually the kitchen.
They will all think you are from Norway,
Simon, one of the dishwashers, shouted, and everyone laughed. If you cooked in Sorrentino's kitchen, you spoke Spanish. Mexico, Puerto Rico, Guatemala, it didn't matter which country. You just couldn't work at Sorrentino's as a chef if you were Italian. It was a policy, a proclamation laid down years ago by the old man.
You hire an Italian to cook in your kitchen and they will change your recipe,
old man Sorrentino had said with disdain.
You hire a Mexican and they do exactly as you say.
The only Italian chef allowed to cook in that kitchen was Sorrentino's nephew, Salvatore, who had gone to the Cordon Bleu of Naples, or whatever the hell was the equivalent, and then worked in Manhattan in two restaurants that were supposedly very la-di-da, but too expensive for Lucinda to try,
not even counting trying to get into the city and to the Upper East Side. Enrique told her a plate of gnocchi was $36. He'd taken his wife and daughter for her confirmation.
A veal chop costs more than a cheap suit. That is the expression, yes?
Yes, Lucinda answered, laughing. Carlos, one of Sorrentino's sauté chefs, followed Salvatore around like a puppy, but it was Lucinda's take that the other guys in the kitchen thought Salvatore was full of himself. Chuchu, the grill chef, called him un perro or un cerdo behind his back, which was a dog or a pig, which exasperated Jose.
You should not be offending the animals.
Part of it was jealousy. After all, he had a real education and real experience. Although his gnocchi were not cloud pillows of perfection like Carlos made, and his veal chop in a balsamic glaze didn't get close to Chuchu's. We got a lot of reservations?
Only the old ones, Jose said, grinning. They come for the noon whistle, he said, smacking the swinging door with his hip and sailing out of the kitchen. ¿Qué miedo this noon mediodía? Chuchu asked. Speak English, Enrique shouted.
It was not her intention to end up waiting tables and being pleasant to people who sent back their steak because this isn't rare, this is mooing, or eating cloud pillows of gnocchi way too late at night, which couldn't be good for her thighs, but was good for her purse and her peace of mind. She'd been in line for the general manager position at Armstrong's when they went out of business, in like 4 hours over some hush-hush crooked money transaction that stunk to high heaven, as her Aunt Angie put it, which happened the week after she'd put her father into the big house and Maria into Ridge Street School first grade. She'd been working at Armstrong's for 12 years, from right after she graduated, married Marty, got pregnant, had the peanut Maria, and Marty got sick and then sicker and actually died. Actually, because who dies when they're 36? A starker Jewish up-and-coming immigration lawyer who could dance like Jimmy Cagney or maybe Mickey Rooney and could actually sew a hem and tell jokes like a borscht belt comic and had basketball hands? Yes. So what the hell was she going to do with no job at Armstrong's? How was she going to pay for everything? She had to call Chief Lang to find out about her dad's pension and insurance. And that Sunday, they'd gone to Sorrentino's for early dinner, her dad and Maria and Angie. And like a gift from the gods, when Marco was cleaning off their table, he told her that Rosa had quit that morning with no notice, and the Sorrentinos were hysterical looking for someone. And Angie had come through for her like Justify winning the Triple Crown at Belmont. I know how to babysit, she said to Lucinda, eyes narrowing, chin raised. I babysat you plenty, didn't I, after your mother ran off into the night? Lucinda smiled. It wasn't in the night, Ange. Ah, the age-old story of her mother running away with Vinny. It's a figure of speech, right? Did I step in and take care of you while your father spent days on that fire engine? Yes, ma'am, you did.
Days, nights, all those hours, busting his ass?
Yes, ma'am.
So I'll step in again. What's the problem?
Well, your time. I don't expect you to give up your life to take care of Maria for me while I'm hustling plates of red sauce.
And what am I supposed to do with my time, missy? Dust? Play mahjong?
Lucinda laughed. You don't play mahjong.
Well, I could learn, Angie said.
And because Etta and Bruno Sorrentino had known her practically since she'd been born, and she'd worked there 2 summers when she was in high school, and they needed somebody fast, since Rosa had up and quit with no notice, a betrayal, Bruno had said, his lips pulled into a thin line like a guy in The Godfather. And because they were more than fair about working out hours with her and the rest of the wait staff so she could see her dad and her kid, she made her peace with it. She bought 3 white blouses and 3 pairs of black slacks with black sneakers and learned how to tie the stupid black tie. After all, she didn't need to sing 3 verses of I Need This Job from a chorus line to know what was up. She would wait tables at Sorrentino's. The first time it happened was last fall, the lovely lull between lunch and dinner. Chuchu put his feet up. Simon had a cigarette in the alley. They actually locked the front door from 3 to 5.
They even turned off the wretched background music, which was barely audible when the restaurant was full, but could make your teeth hurt when you could hear it. Italian.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?